Let's go to Numbers chapter 5. Numbers chapter 5. This morning we look at a passage that will be very strange by our modern cultural standards. And I want to bring a message we'll simply title A Wedge of Suspicion. There is a lot in this passage that the modern ear may struggle with, but would make complete sense in the ancient world. And in Numbers chapter 5, we have a story. We'll begin it in verse 11. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, If any man's wife go aside and commit a trespass against him, and a man lie with her carnally, and it be hid from the eyes of her husband, and be kept close, and she be defiled, and there be no witness against her, neither she be taken with the manner, and a spirit of jealousy come upon him, and he be jealous of his wife, and she be defiled. Or, if the spirit of jealousy come upon him, and he be jealous of his wife, and she be not defiled, then shall the man bring his wife unto the priest, and he shall bring her offering for her, a tenth part of the ephah of barley meal. She shall pour no oil upon it, neither put frankincense thereon. For it is an offering of jealousy, an offering of memorial, bringing iniquity to remembrance. And in verse 17, you can see how the priest takes part in this ritual. And the priest shall take holy water from an earthen vessel, and of the dust that is in the floor of the tabernacle of the priest shall take and put it into the water. And this will mix together, as we will see, the woman will drink the water. And then in due time, in verse 27, And when he hath made her to drink the water, it shall come to pass that if she be defiled and have done trespass against her husband, that the water that causes the curse shall enter into her and shall become bitter, and her belly shall swell and her thigh shall rot, and the woman shall be a curse among her people. And if the woman be not defiled, but be clean, then she shall be free and conceive seed. This is the law of jealousies. When a wife goeth aside to another instead of her husband, and is defiled, or when the spirit of jealousy cometh upon him, and he be jealous over his wife, and shall set the woman before the Lord, and the priest shall execute upon her all this law. And so we have something that's very strange, if this is the first time you've ever heard this. And I just want to talk on the topic that we'll title A Wedge of Suspicion. Very specifically, we have a passage here where there's suspicion or some kind of jealousy between a husband and a wife. And there's this little ritual in ancient Israel that perhaps if we look at it, it will help us deal with any kind of suspicion that may be in a marital relationship. Recently, in one advice column, it was written from somebody who just signs the name Marilyn. Marilyn writes, Over recent years, I have suspected my husband of cheating on me, which he hotly denies. He tells me my jealousy is damaging our marriage and that I wouldn't worry if I really trusted him. However, after a bit of snooping, the evidence is mounting. Given that he is a good father and, at this point, I really don't want to divorce him, my question is, do I just carry on as normal or do I hire a detective to get some hard evidence? I wonder if by presenting him with the evidence, if we could get to the root of the problem and fix our marriage. Now, Marilyn's story here is just classic. Not just classic for today, but classic in marriage relationships that have existed since the fall of man. One spouse suspects the other of straying, and they begin to pull away from the relationship. The other spouse, the accused, says, It's all in your head. The problem is with your insecurity, and before long, there is a wedge of suspicion that drives the husband and a wife apart from each other. And the principle that we find in this passage is that marital suspicion destroys the intimacy of the relationship, whether it's real or whether it's perceived. Suspicion breaks down the intimacy that God has designed for a man, a husband, and a wife to enjoy. And here in Numbers chapter 5, we have a situation where the husband becomes very jealous. And he isn't quite sure if his wife is straying or not. He's just jealous. There are no witnesses. There is no hard evidence. But something is going on that really causes this husband concern. Could it be that she was alone with another man at some point? Has she changed in her the way she responds to her husband? Does she just seem disinterested? Is there a rumor that's making its way through the grapevine? We cannot be sure. The only thing we know is that the husband has become suspicious and is breaking down the intimacy in the relationship. Now, presumably, the wife, at least at first, is saying something like, "This is all in your head. You're crazy. Your imagination is running wild. You're the one breaking down the intimacy," or, "He's only a friend, he's only a co-worker, you have nothing to worry about." But at any rate, suspicion is destroying this relationship. And as you know, the larger the suspicion, the larger the wedge between a husband and a wife. Suspicion comes at many levels. At the most destructive level, one spouse accuses the other of committing adultery. At a lesser level, one fears that the spouse has eyes for someone else, that they'd rather be with someone else. And then at the street level, it occurs where one spouse accuses the other of being involved in perhaps pornography or some online kind of a relationship where there's some emotional adultery taking place. There are all different levels of suspicion. And regardless of which level is in play, the suspicion breaks down the intimacy in the marriage relationship. Now, let me just step back as a pastor and just kind of speak to you for just a second as a congregation. As a pastor, I am concerned about divorce here at Super Road Baptist Church. And I thank the Lord that He has protected us in many ways, and by His grace, there hasn't been an outbreak of this, although it happens from time to time. I am concerned about suspicion and jealousy leading to something like divorce. But even more than that, because it's far more common than divorce, my fear for most couples at Super Road is not divorce, because most of you know the Bible too well to take that step. My fear is that you, your husband and wife, that you turn into very good roommates. That's the fear I have for most people at Super Road. You share the chores, you share the children, you share the bills, you even share a bedroom. You share everything except the intimacy that God wants you to have in your relationship. And for many, that intimacy begins to break down. It may not lead to something like divorce, but it begins to break down. And before long, there's bitterness, there's suspicion, there's jealousy, and you find yourself living like very good roommates instead of the husband and wife that God has saved you to be. Now, let's take this passage this way. First of all, let's look at the ritual itself, and then I want to answer some objections on this ritual, and then we'll just draw some principles that can help us in our marriage relationships. Now, notice the ritual, first of all. It begins, of course, by the suspicious husband in verse 15, bring his wife with a cereal offering before the priest. Now, FYI, the barley or the cereal offering here is one of the cheapest sacrifices in the Bible. Fine flour was required in the area of known sin for a sin offering. This is a very inexpensive sacrifice that's brought forth. In verse 16, the priest takes the woman into the court of tabernacles before the Lord. And then in the subsequent verse, verse 17, he takes an earthen vessel, he puts some kind of water in it, mixes it with dust from the floor of the tabernacle. And according to Leviticus 7, 22 and Numbers chapter 9, someone who ate of a sacrifice while they were unclean was liable to sudden death. The dust is taken from the presence of the Lord, and certainly this is more lethal than just your average sacrifice. The priest in verse 18 goes back to the woman. She unbinds her hair. She lets her hair down, and then a sacrifice is done. And what is the picture of the woman letting her hair down? Some people say that's a picture of being unclean, and that is in the Bible. Lepers, for example, were required to wear their hair down because they were unclean by Old Testament standards. But the woman letting her hair down is probably not a sign of being unclean. It's a sign of being open before the Lord, that she is willing to be examined by the Lord. And it's a sign that the Lord can search her heart and search her life. She is open to this kind of investigation. In verse 19 through 20, he holds the water in his hand and recites a curse. You can see in verse 22 that the woman says, "Amen, amen." In other words, "If I am guilty, let all this happen to me." Now, what exactly is the judgment that would take place in this case if the woman was guilty? There's a lot of debate, but I think the best answer for this, and we won't read through all the passages, but it talks about the thigh and the belly, and then you see later on in the passage in verse 28, she shall conceive seed. It seems that the judgment is not death, but infertility of some kind. And so if the woman is guilty, she'll be infertile, and if she's not, she will have children. The priest writes down the curses, wipes them off with holy water. She drinks the water, and then presumably, of course, if she is guilty, all this will happen to her. Now, let's get the elephant out of the room right away. This is bizarre, at least by our standard. This is strange. And if this is the first time you've ever heard of this ritual in the Bible, probably what you're saying is how can God be in something like this? I mean, how can the Lord permit something like this to take place? This is just really strange by 21st century standards. Let me give you four objections to this and then try to answer them the best I can. Number one, a lot of people have a cultural objection to this ritual. And what they say is that trial by ordeal just isn't fair. What we have in front of us is something called a trial by ordeal. That's a judicial practice where the guilt or innocence of a person is determined by subjecting them to some task. And a lot of us say, how can God be in something like this? Trial by ordeal is just foreign to us. In a minute, I will argue that most women in the ancient world would vote in favor of something like this. But until then, let me just say this. This is very strange by Western standards, but this is very common throughout most of the world. I recently saw a documentary where in many African villages, trial by ordeal is incredibly common. In the ancient world, almost every culture had some kind of trial by ordeal, though a little bit different than this one. It's especially common in the East. I think it's okay for us to say this is a little bizarre by our standards, but let me say this. To judge them by our own Western standards would not be very pluralistic or secular of us, so let's not do that. And I want you to notice here that this little ritual is not drink the poison and see if you live. This is a very controlled environment. It's taken place in the presence of the priest. It's taken place in the presence of the tabernacle. The woman is not drinking poison. She's drinking water. And the Lord would have to intervene in order to bring about this judgment. And so this is not guilty until proven innocent. This really is innocent until proven guilty. In most other cultures, if you read about trial by ordeal, it involves something like throwing yourself into a fire. In most cultures, trial by ordeal meant you were guilty until you prove yourself innocent. A woman may be accused of adultery in one of these other ancient cultures. And one of these rituals might be, you know, see this boiling water, put your hand in the boiling water. And if you pull your hand out and your hand is not scarred, then obviously you're innocent. If not, you're guilty. Or grab onto this iron hot, you know, rod with your hand and see if your hand isn't burned, and then you'll be innocent. There's no pain involved in this. This is water that the woman is drinking. It's not drink the poison and then see if you live. And so I don't think the cultural objection stands. Number two, there seems to be a religious objection. And once again, some people read this and say, this is nothing more than magic. Woman drinks the substance and, you know, everybody kind of stands around to see if she dies. But that's not the picture here. The woman drinks the water, and then what does she do after she drinks the water? You know what she does? She goes home to her husband. And presumably they carry on as husband and wife. Again, this is not God has to intervene to save you. This is God has to intervene to show you guilty. Number three, and I think this is the most common objection to most people that read this, I think there's a sociological objection. And some people say, this is just chauvinistic. I mean, you know, you and I read this and we say, male chauvinism at its best. What about the guy who she committed adultery presumably with? What happens to him? And why is it that it's always the woman committing adultery? What about the husband here? Here we have a male-dominated society, and no doubt the religious leaders of the day were males, and they're putting down or oppressing a woman here without even evidence to do so. And so on the surface, this looks like some kind of male chauvinism, but here's what I think you and I are missing when we read it from our own cultural standpoint. I would suggest that this was not an opportunity for a man to put his wife in place. I would suggest to you that this was actually a ritual that was intended to protect the woman from a jealous husband. In our day and age, when a woman is accused of something, she can leave her house and go to the shelter. She can leave her house and perhaps go to a neighbor's house. She can call the police for protection. There was nothing like that in place in the first century. In the first century, if a woman was just accused of committing adultery, it would not be uncommon for that woman just to show up missing the next day without any witnesses, without any trial whatsoever. And in many cultures in the ancient world, a woman could be divorced, banished, or even put to death on mere suspicion of adultery. And by the way, the fathers and the brothers, they would have no problem with this in the ancient world. Read the book of Esther and look at how quick the king puts the queen away just on a little whim. In the ancient world, there was nothing in place to protect a woman from a malicious, jealous husband. Congregation, this is not God's way of oppressing the wife. This is God's way of protecting the wife. This is God's way of saying to the husband, don't you dare take action against your wife without bringing this to light and allowing the priest to be a part of this. The Lord is saying to the men in this ritual, you are not stable enough to do this on your own. Go get the priest. And this ritual would interrupt that jealous husband from just trying to banish his wife or have her turn up missing the next day. I would suggest to you that every single woman in ancient Israel would vote in favor of this ritual because this would protect them. This was not oppressive to them. The last little objection would be this, and I'll just throw this out. Some of us, when we read this passage, we have a practical objection. Cultural, religious, social, and then and we say, couldn't this be a little bit easier than this? I mean, why do I got to mix all this stuff together and have somebody drink something? Why not just pray, you know? Why not just, you know, draw in the dirt and see what happens? You know, I mean, you could do something much easier. Why all this ritual? But you have to remember that all these rituals in the ancient world had significance. They were dramas that helped people understand what God was doing. Just like today, look, do you know how much money we spent at the inauguration for the president this year? Wouldn't it be easier to put that on YouTube, you know? But the truth is, we all know, and many of us support that because we think it's a big deal and something needs to be made of it. Most people in this room opt for a wedding instead of eloping, but eloping is much easier, is it not? Why? There is symbolism in the wedding that you want everybody to see. Same with this ritual. Yes, there was probably an easier way to do it, but God is communicating something to Israel through this ritual. He wants them to see something in this ritual, and so that objection really doesn't stand either. And so now that we've seen all these objections, here's where I want us to get. What is the Lord teaching us about jealousy and suspicion in marriage? And again, let's restate the obvious and go from there. Number one, we're dealing with the topic of suspicion. Not guilt, but suspicion. Moses assumes that something has happened that triggers some sort of jealousy here. There's no witnesses, but some kind of halo data is going off here. It could be that one spouse got caught in a lie. Perhaps they're not as guarded as they should be. Whispers going on. One spouse asks a question, the other refuses to answer it. We aren't quite sure. Perhaps the husband is just very insecure. The wife is too flirtatious. We have no idea, but a wedge of suspicion is driven into this marriage. Now, congregation, how do most people deal with suspicion when it comes into the marital relationship? When suspicion comes into marriage, most people take one of two roads. You either go on the offense or you go on the defense. Some of us, when we're accused, we go on the offensive. We say things like, it's your jealousy, it's not mine, so you need to deal with it. You have no witnesses. You have no proof. All we have is these empty words. You've looked and looked and looked, and you have nothing. It's all in your head. You need to get over it. On the other hand, some of us become very defensive if we're accusing. And we say things like, look, it's your fault that I'm jealous. You make me jealous. You act a certain way around certain people, and that just raises suspicion. Certainly I have no proof, but I have good reason to be jealous. The way you dress, the way you talk, the way you act around certain people, you know that bothers me and you still do that. And so the conversation takes place in most homes. You make me jealous. No, it's all in your head. It's your fault. That's how the world deals with jealousy and suspicion. Now, how should we as the church, the people of God, deal with suspicion in marriage? Let me give you five or so principles. Number one, the first thing we see is you need to attempt to deal with the suspicion and jealousy. You as a husband and a wife need to attempt to deal with this. Jealousy and suspicion is far too easily dismissed. Whether real or perceived, the easy thing to do is just sweep it under the carpet, never talk about it, and go on living like really good roommates. That's the easy thing to do, but that's not the biblical thing to do. What God is calling the husband and wife to do in this passage is to communicate with each other about what's presumably taking place. Both need to be willing to come to the table. The easy thing in Numbers chapter 5 is for the wife to say, it's in your head, don't bother me with this, and the husband to say, okay, I won't ever bring it up again. But that does not fix the problem. The jealousy and the suspicion is there, and apparently there's good reason that it is. And I would suggest to you, if suspicion and jealousy are in your marriage, and maybe it's something that's been there for a long time, maybe it's something that's just come up recently, I think both parties ought to do all they can to try to honor the Lord in their communication on this subject. The easy thing to do is to just skate over it and go on as good roommates, but that's not what God calls a husband and a wife to do here. Number two, and this is more importantly, marriage is so intimate and so holy in God's eyes, your spouse's suspicion becomes your burden too. Your spouse's suspicion becomes your burden too. See, if you're the party under suspicion, the easy thing to say, once again, is this is your problem, not mine. Especially if you're innocent, you're going to tend to do that. Especially if it really is in your spouse's head. Or perhaps they're really insecure. Maybe they're going through a hard time and you just kind of think they're taking something out on you. That's when it becomes very easy just to say, you deal with this, I don't want to deal with this. But what we learn in this passage is that your spouse's burden of suspicion also becomes your burden of suspicion. A spiritual Christian is willing to do all they can, listen to me, all they can to remove suspicion and jealousy from the marriage relationship. What I love about Numbers chapter 5 is the woman is involved in the process here, the one that's accused. She doesn't say, you go deal with this, I'm not dealing with it. Apparently, presumably, she is willing to do all she can to remove any suspicion that her husband has of her in this passage. Remember the vows you took when you stood perhaps in this church or somewhere else? And you said, I will love you, I will be true in sickness and in health. Sane and insane, whatever your vows involved. I think if you're the one being accused by your spouse, here's the question you need to answer. Will you love your spouse enough to help them shoulder this burden of suspicion they have of you? Do you love them enough to help them through a season of suspicion, even if it's without foundation? Even if you're 100% innocent, even if it's their own insecurity that's driving this thing, do you love your spouse enough to say, I'm sorry you feel that way. What do I have to do to remove suspicion? I'm willing to take any steps I can. Because the woman here is very involved in the process. Rather than get defensive, the constructive response is, what can I do to remove suspicion in your eyes? Let me give you just some easy example. Number one, very practical. Are you willing to let your spouse get on your computer at any time to see where you've been, who you've been talking to, what you've been looking at? If that would help remove suspicion, were you willing to do that? Are you willing to let your spouse say to you, I'm really concerned about you and that other person associating with each other. That really kind of bothers me. Can you please back off that relationship? Does your spouse feel they can say something like that to you about any person at all? And maybe the suspicion is not even in a moral area. Maybe it's in the area of finances. Maybe it's how you spend your time. In what way can your spouse approach you about these things? If both parties are not willing to shoulder the burden on the suspicion, there is little hope for a return of intimacy. And let me say this, congregation. The response of the gospel when you're accused is not defensive, but compassion. Compassion. One of understanding. I remind you that Christ was falsely accused too. And he hung like a criminal, a crime that he never committed. They put him on a cross. They accused him of leading a political revolt. Nothing could be further from the truth. They had no foundation to say. No witnesses ever came forward on that. The response that most of us would have said is, how dare you accuse me of something like that? It's all in your head. You falsely accuse me because of your own insecurity. But instead, Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And rather than moving on the defensive, Jesus Christ was moved with compassion. And I would suggest the same should be true in our marriage relationships. Rather than getting defensive, rather than saying it's all in your head, it's all your insecurity, I'm 100% innocent, the biblical response is, how can I help in this area? To be moved with compassion at a feeling that your spouse has. The Christian response is one of compassion. Number three, the goal in marriage is not innocence, but to be above reproach. The goal in marriage should not be to be innocent, but to be above reproach. I suggest to you that innocence in marriage is far too low of a standard. And if your standard or your marriage relationship is just to be innocent, you are going to be excellent roommates in just a couple years. I want you to know that. You have to be willing to live above reproach, not just at the level of innocence. The fact of the matter is, if you're a husband in this room, you could be in a room with another woman and be completely innocent, but that doesn't make you above reproach. And if you're a woman and you're online typing and perhaps trying to cover your tracks in some way, it may even be very innocent, but that is not living above reproach. I remind you, what's driving the husband and wife apart in Numbers 5 is not guilt, it's suspicion. And it's jealousy. Christian husbands and wives must rise beyond the level of mere innocence and be willing to live above reproach. Have to live by that higher standard. Number four, I want you to notice that the community was involved in the reconciliation. The Christian community is somewhat involved in the reconciliation. There are basically, I'll just throw these out, three levels of accountability in marriage. If you talk to everybody in the world, you know, what are the levels, how do you hold yourself accountable in marriage? I think you'll find basically three levels. Level number one is the secular level. In the secular world, marriage only answers to itself. If you commit a sin, you answer to your spouse. And so if you ask the average secularist, well, you know, how do you hold each other accountable? They would say, well, she holds me accountable, I hold her accountable. If I do something wrong, I have to answer to the marriage itself. And so that's the secular level. Other people, their accountability is at what we would call the religious level. Traditional religious people believe that marriage is accountable to God, which we agree with. Marriage is accountable to God. In other words, when you sin, you don't just sin against your spouse, you sin against God. And when you sin, you are accountable not just to your marriage, but you are also accountable to the Lord. That's your traditional marriage approach. You have the secular level, you have the religious level, but I would suggest to you that what we see here is the Christian level. The Christian level. And what we find in Numbers 5 is that Christian people believe that marriage is not just accountable to itself, though it is, and it's not just accountable to God. The marriage is accountable also to the Christian community itself. See, a lot of people say, look, you know, in my marriage, someday I'm going to have to answer to the Lord. Someday if I sin, I'll have to stand before the Lord and give an account. That's not what this passage is teaching. This passage teaches not someday, but right now, you stand and give an account before the priest. You stand and answer to the Christian community. This is classic. Classic 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and Matthew 18. And if you're a believer in Jesus Christ, if you're someone who said, I believe in Christ, I'm following him with my whole heart, I'm going to be accountable to a local church, your marriage is not just accountable to itself, it's not just accountable to the Lord, it is accountable to other brothers and sisters in Christ. And why is that? We don't have time to flesh this out. But unfaithfulness in your marriage, unfaithfulness, does not just affect your house. It affects the whole body of Christ. And it can hinder the fellowship of the entire church. Last principle is this. Last principle. We must recognize that God is the ultimate judge. God is the ultimate judge. Turn over to verse 29 with me, if you would. Verse 29 says, and this is the law of jealousies. When a wife goeth aside to another instead of her husband, and she is defiled, Or when a spirit of jealousy cometh upon him, and he be jealous over his wife, and get this, shall set the woman before the Lord, and the priests shall execute upon her all this law. The overriding principle in Numbers chapter 5 is that you need to be willing to commit your marriage to Christ. That's the overall principle here. The husband brings his marriage before the priest, just as we bring our marriage before our high priest, Jesus Christ. And the priest examines the relationship and judges according to what happens. And so it is with Christ. As we bring our marriage before the Lord, he is the ultimate judge. Let me give you some practical applications. The point here is that God is in control of your spouse. That's what this is teaching. And I would suggest to you that the question in marriage is not, do I trust my spouse? The biblical question is, do I trust God with my spouse? Let me just be frank with you, congregation. Every one of us in here is a sinner. Do you realize you have the potential to sin just like, the greatest sinner you know? The most spiritual spouse in this room right now has the potential to run off and stray from their spouse. The fact of the matter is, all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. For every reason you give me why you can trust your spouse, I can give you two why you shouldn't trust them. That's the truth. You can say they're trustworthy, and I could say you really don't know them as well as you think. You can say they never look at dirty things, and I can say, how do you really know that? Listen, it's very possible even today that they're very trustworthy, but tomorrow they're not. Every instance you can tell me you can trust them in, I can give you two reasons why you can't trust them, and you could do the same for me. The fact of the matter is, the question is not, do I trust my spouse, though I hope that's true. The question is, do I trust God with my spouse? Is God big enough to take care of my marriage? Is God big enough to protect them from sin? Is God big enough to chasten them if they do sin? Is God big enough to protect me if I become a victim in this relationship? At the end of the day, the call here is not just to trust your spouse, though I hope it's in place. The call here is to trust the Lord in your marriage relationship. And what we learn here is that God is big enough to protect and chasten where you cannot. We have a classic example of this in the Bible. I think about the story of Bathsheba, where she strayed from her husband with the king himself. Do you realize her husband died never knowing about that sin? He was never even the least bit suspicious that his wife strayed, but the Lord knew. And even after the death of her husband, God sent a prophet to confront that adulterous couple, and the Lord chastened them according to his will. You see, my friends, the way you deal with insecurity in marriage is not becoming more controlling, but by trusting God and trusting his control. And if you find yourself very suspicious, or you're the one under suspicion, you want to do all you can to communicate. You want to do all you can to try to repair these things on a human level. But at the end of the day, at the end of this passage, we realize, if we Christians believe, God is big enough to protect, he's big enough to chasten, and he's big enough to protect me if something happens. Question is not, do I trust my spouse? I hope that's true. But do you trust the Lord with your spouse? Let's close with prayer.